Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. This week, we're connecting the dots between millennials, big tents, and a heated election. I know. How are all of these things connected? Well, we're going to find out with Christian Paz, senior politics reporter at Vox, and Max Rivlin-Nadler, reporter and co-publisher at Hellgate, a local news site for New York City. Christian, Max, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Okay, I am a longtime New York City resident. This year makes 13 years. Max, you also live in New York. How would you describe the energy around this year's Democratic mayoral primary and the energy in New York on Tuesday night?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had the highest voter turnout in New York City mayoral races since 1989. Still only around 1/3 of registered Democrats voted, but because New York City is such a massive city, that's still over 1 million people voted, which is more people than vote in several Senate races.
Wow.
So people were tuned into this race. You know, I'm somebody who covers this day in and day out over at Hellgate, and I was floored by what we saw here. I thought we were going to be in for several days of vote tabulation, that ranked choice voting was going to come into play. And sure enough, it was pretty much decided by the end of the night that Zohran Mamdani had won.
Yeah, I mean, I was so caught off guard. I was watching the results at home with my husband. Well, at first we were switching back and forth between watching the results come in and Love Island. Like, is Olandra going to stay in the house? What's going on? But it became pretty clear that the race was going to be tied up much more quickly than either one of us had anticipated. Once we saw Cuomo give his concession speech, you know, I'm nosy. That's why I got into journalism. I told my husband, I was like, let's go to the bars in the neighborhood. Like, let's see what's going on. And people were talking about this race with their friends and neighbors on a Tuesday. And it makes sense that they would. Like, I did not see a single poll that predicted a first round presumptive win like this for Mamdani. For those who don't know, there were two big candidates. One was former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who had been in power for a decade when he resigned due to allegations of sexual assault, which he denied. And Zohran Mamdani, a New York State Assembly member for Queens who first entered office 4 years ago. And these candidates, though both Democrats, sit on fairly distinct sides of the party. Cuomo positioned himself as more of a centrist. Mamdani's a total progressive. Cuomo is older and spent years entrenched in the Democratic Party. Mamdani is younger and newer to politics, and he comes out of the Democratic Socialists of America. And while I live in New York, so I have personal interest in this race, I can see that this Democratic primary election has made an impression on the rest of the country, too. I mean, even before primary day, the story was national news because, you know, the Democrats were bringing in the big guns for this. Cuomo was endorsed by Bill Clinton, and Mamdani gained endorsements from Bernie Sanders and AOC. And of course, even as ranked choice voting means the final vote won't become known for a bit longer, Mamdani is the presumptive winner. Cuomo conceded on Tuesday night after Mamdani held a 7-point lead at 43%. Mamdani was polling at 1% to Cuomo's 33% in February, so this is a huge upset. But ultimately, I see this primary as sort of a referendum on where the Democratic Party is headed post-Trump 2024 re-election. So I'm here with Christian and Max to get into the expanding tent of the Democratic Party and the changing face of progressive voters in New York City and beyond. So, first of all, thinking about some of the polling we saw going into this race, we saw some real generational breaks in the polling for this primary before people even hit the polls. According to an Emerson poll the day before the vote, voters under 50 supported Mamdani by a 2-to-1 margin, while Cuomo was strong among older voters. And young voters really showed out in early voting. Data from Gothamist shows that the two age groups who cast the most early votes were 25 to 34-year-olds and 35 to 44-year-olds. And they say that young people don't vote. And that is kind of actually true on a larger scale. But what made this primary different?
One thing that I'm going to be looking for as we get more solid data is just how big of a segment of the electorate that younger voter demographic ended up being. Because I was seeing some estimates that kind of 18 to 30, 18 to 34 segment of the electorate might be bigger than previous primaries or even than was previously projected, which is maybe why some of the polling maybe was off in the lead up to this. I'm particularly interested in that because it makes the narrative post 2024 a little bit more complicated in that we did see massive shifts among younger voters to the Republican column, whether that was nationally them voting for Trump in other polls as particularly young men identify more conservative, seeing instead that there was a surge of younger voter turnout this time around in New York City's primary, it's going to lead to some debate over whether the way to win back younger voters or the way to win back younger men specifically lies in specifically ideological or policy positions, whether it's about populism and about enthusiasm and something about the unique ability of someone like Zohran Mamdani to be able to get to these voters.
Right. I think what Mamdani was really able to do here was to change the conversation around this election to the issue that he was strongest on, which was affordability, right? Mm. So Cuomo wanted to run a campaign based on the city is dangerous and it is chaotic and I must save it. And I think what people, especially younger people, look around the city and they go like, I like living here. I love living here. The major issue facing me is that I can't keep living here because if I want to buy a house or have affordable rent or start a family or, you know, afford childcare, if I start that family, I will need to leave the city. So one thing that Mamdani did right at the beginning of his campaign, he announced in October, Trump obviously wins in November. And the first viral video that he makes is he goes up to the Bronx and he's just standing there with a microphone and he's interviewing people in this neighborhood that flipped pretty hard towards Trump, where everyone was going, oh my God, you know, we're losing lower income Black and Latino communities. What's going on? Why is the Democratic Party not connecting with them? And he's having honest conversations about, you know, why'd you guys vote for Trump? And they were all telling him things like rent, groceries, the subway fare keeps going up.
Yeah.
I can't afford childcare. I can't afford to, you know, keep up with rising costs.
Have you voted for Democrats in the past?
I have.
And what would it take for you to vote for a Democrat in the future?
Being able to pay attention to the regular Americans and their economic needs.
He then builds his campaign platform about those, you know, concerns that people have. Free universal childcare, freezing rent for rent-stabilized tenants, cheaper grocery stores, right? He wants to do city-owned grocery stores.
Right.
And he wants to make buses free. So all of a sudden, by launching his campaign on that, he changed the conversation. It went from crime and chaos.
Like the law and order kind of framing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To affordability. He was able to turn the conversation to an issue of affordability.
You know, New York City is at a moment where a lot of people are feeling vulnerable and a lot of people are feeling like they lack stability. That's kind of a sentiment I think that many young people share kind of more broadly across the country. And it sounds like Mamdani had a message that could penetrate with that group. Coming up, the possible parallels between this moment for the Democrats and the 2007 Republican Party.
I've been seeing a lot about, you know, a kind of Democratic Tea Party moment that isn't necessarily just about age or just about ideology, but is more about confrontation and more of a challenge to the status quo and to establishment Democrats.
Stick around. Something I also want to talk about in this race is one of the critiques of the Mamdani campaign is that he's well-liked by a certain kind of white, highly educated, upper-middle-class voter. But according to an Emerson poll the day before the vote, Black voters as a whole polled higher for Cuomo. We're still waiting on exact demographic breakdowns, but we do have breakdowns based on neighborhood. And Mamdani did do very well in some neighborhoods that were rich and white, but he also pulled ahead in some majority Black, Asian, and Latino neighborhoods like Crown Heights, Sunset Park, and Jackson Heights. I also saw a graph by Owen Winter, a political data journalist at The Economist, that showed areas with a higher percentage of millennials went for Mamdani across all races, but Black millennials especially. So I wonder, what is the image of a progressive voter? And how does that stack up to how things shook out in this race?
Yeah, I think for me, it was definitely, when I was looking at returns at least, I was shocked at how well Zohran was doing in some more diverse places. The expectation that a lot of, especially nationally, observers, pundits had going into this was that we would see some of the same kind of demographic, class, race breakdowns that we've seen national races kind of applying here too, where you'd have a more progressive, a more educated, a wealthier electorate kind of siding with the more progressive candidate here, and that you have working class, minority voters, less tuned into politics, leaning toward the center, as tends to happen in a lot of other races around the country, siding with Cuomo. And I think Zoran Mamdani not doing as badly in some of those diverse places. I think that's why my first thought was this is definitely going to scramble some of the post-2024 thinking about what the party needs to do in terms of winning back certain groups of voters, that the party is viewed too left-leaning, that the party is viewed as too radical, and that that is off-putting. There will be more conversations now. There will be more debate over, you know, how much of this was about the strategy and the actual campaigning, about the organizing, about what platforms were used to reach voters, and also just some thinking about like what positions the party has to take in terms of, you know, social, economic things.
Right. It used to be like the limousine liberal, and maybe now it's like the cargo bike progressive. You know, it's kind of upper middle class, upwardly mobile, brownstone Brooklyn. That's the image of the progressive voter. But I think especially in New York City, that really undersells kind of what's been going on at the grassroots level, obviously for like decades, but especially in the post-2016 moment. You're seeing a lot of activity in neighborhoods like Sunset Park, which is heavily Asian and Latino, Jackson Heights, which is every ethnicity under the sun. Really, you know, these organizations are running their own candidates. These are people from the community. It's not, hey, sign on to this white progressive. Some of Mamdani's fellow legislative class, Marcella Matanes, who is an assembly member from Sunset Park, she came from, you know, anti-gentrification work, things like that. There are a whole wellspring of new organizers, new politicians, new people who can move people to the polls and be effective communicators that are doing this work one way or the other, right? Whether they get brought into the Democratic Party fold or not. And that's where places like New York City DSA are able to identify really charismatic and great messengers for what they're trying to put out there, like a Zoran Mamdani, like an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, right? These are extremely telegenic, extremely charismatic individuals who, you know, on paper, you could say like, oh, they're part of the, you know, quote unquote loony left or whatever. And then when they actually get into people's, you know, living rooms and you hear them talk, a lot of people's response, well, I mean, that makes sense. And I think that's exactly what happened in New York City over the past few months is when, you know, things get presented as, oh, well, that's crazy. Universal childcare that we can't afford that. It's, well, we just expanded pre-K a few years ago and
that's true.
We'll make buses free. Mamdani did a pilot project when he's still a state legislator. It's basically the ability to communicate these seemingly far left policies in a way that people can understand. That's not something that I think fits any type of archetype that we have so far when it comes to progressives. I think you saw a progressive lane in this race that was filled by Brad Lander, very much in the Elizabeth Warren mold of, I've got a plan for that. Here's my 30-page plan for that. Voters do not have time for the 30-page plan. They have time for the 90-second TikTok. And if you have people who are effective at communicating that way, then you're going to see an absolute shift in who we consider to be the Democratic progressive base.
But one thing that's been interesting in covering a lot of like progressive versus moderate, centrist versus left, you know, elections or races that end up getting filtered through that lens is that plenty of voters don't necessarily view themselves according to those labels. Many don't necessarily call themselves progressives, but might hold views that are more progressive. Many might call themselves just a Democrat, right? And that identity has been shifting over time too. What the Democratic base at least wants isn't necessarily cleanly split between more moderation or more of a shift to the left, but more than anything, a response to Republicans and a forward-looking agenda or vision for what the party should be. And that's why some of the conversation that I've been watching since Tuesday night has been interesting in that it talks a lot, or I'm seeing a lot about, you know, a kind of Democratic Tea Party moment that's been forming across the country over the last year that isn't necessarily just about age or just about ideology, but is more about confrontation, about, you know, meeting the moment and more of a challenge to the status quo and to establishment Democrats in particular. So I don't even know if it's specifically about progressive versus centrist, moderate. It's become a little bit broader and reminds me a lot of that Tea Party movement from 10 years ago.
Such an interesting parallel. So I want to bring this to the national scale. I feel like we've seen some millennial and a couple Gen Z politicians come through, and they tend to be more progressive, but they've dealt with a lot of headwinds, often coming from other Democrats. The Democrats are definitely at a crossroads after the reelection of Trump. And some say the Republican tent is big, and it feels to me like there's more policing of who can be in the Democrats' tent, both from the left and the center, even as though there's a recognition from some Democrats that they need to have their own Joe Rogans. They need to have their own sort of figures that are kind of asking provocative questions and bringing in everyday people into political conversations. How did we see that tension play out in this mayoral primary? And what lesson should we be taking sort of from this result about how to think about these things going forward?
Yeah, I mean, listen, this is going to cause a massive shakeup in the Democratic Party. Just because, again, New York City, best city in the world, media capital of the world, the Democratic nominee for the mayor is a Muslim democratic socialist who believes in human rights for Palestinians. The playbook that Cuomo ran was hitting him relentlessly on Israel-Palestine, and he had a lot of money backing him up to do that. And Mamdani, he didn't back away. And voters basically said, listen, we do not believe that the Democratic Party needs to be tied to the Netanyahu government in Israel as their first priority. So that's going to be something that is going to have to keep playing out, right? Because I think you'll see people running popularly on the left with, you know, stances that are in direct opposition to major Democratic donors. So the donor base of the Democratic Party is going to have a massive problem with these candidates. So I think this is going to drag out. There is not going to be anything neat going into the midterms.
There are a lot of lessons to be taken, and there's also a risk of overreading into a municipal off-year election. You're right that there is a lot of conversation about, you know, are Democrats or left-leaning or liberal, you know, candidates and their platforms too exclusionary of each other, where everybody's trying to police each other about, you know, who is truly leftist, who is truly a socialist, who is truly a centrist, who is truly a moderate. You know, have you condemned this? Have you responded to that? To bring it back to the parallel I was drawing to the Tea Party moment, that was some of what drove that movement, some internal policing about who was truly conservative, who was truly Republican. There is still a question about, you know, just how much the shifts last year were permanent demographic or ideological shifts. I've been tracking, right, how durable the Trump appeal and the Republican Party's hold on voters of color has remained this year. We've already seen some losses on the Republican side in polling as far as Black and Latino voters, younger voters who maybe took a chance on Trump last year and are now fleeing the Republican side, but they're not necessarily fleeing to the Democratic side yet. And that's where I think there are lessons for the Democrats about how to reach, how to communicate, who to recruit to reach these voters. Whether what does well with those kinds of voters makes sense for general elections in battleground districts in, you know, the Southwest, in Virginia, I think it's a little too early to draw a definitive conclusion on.
We'll have to see how it unfolds. But oh my gosh, Max, Christian, I have learned so much here. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Christian Paz, senior politics reporter at Vox, and Max Rivlin Nadler, reporter and co-publisher at Hellgate. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Liam McBain.
This episode was edited by
Nina Patak.
Our supervising producer is
Barton Girdwood.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sangueni.
All right. That's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.